From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, before the proposal to save the domes is publicly presented to the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors, we look at some of the obstacles it faces.
Over time, they've run into maintenance problems and leaking windows and crumbling aspects to the building. And this, of course, is just one small part of the larger problem of Milwaukee County having this huge backlog in deferred maintenance projects.
Then we learn about the state's early gay history from the author of We've Been Here All Along.
Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
We hear about the scourge of the KK can opener, and Beats Me explains what it means to be a sanctuary city. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The Mitchell Park Domes is one of the most iconic buildings in Milwaukee. These large glass structures are home to a wide array of plants, from cacti and succulents in the desert dome to fruit trees and ferns in the tropical dome. But the domes have been in need of repair for a long time, and there are many opinions on what the path forward should look like. After nearly 3 years of work, the domes task force has recommended a business plan and conceptual design for the building. They will present their proposal to the Milwaukee County Board of Supervisors tomorrow night at the Mitchell Park Domes Annex at 6 o'clock. Tom Dakin is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins me every month to talk about commercial real estate and development in the area. Tom, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy. Happy to be here.
So what is the history of this space, of the domes?
They were built in the early 60s, geodesic dome, which was kind of a popular thing at the time. And they're very striking. Obviously, they're one of probably the best known Milwaukee landmarks. Many people have been there. I suppose probably most of your listeners have been there. If not, they've seen it driving past on I-94 looking south down towards Mitchell Park. And they served their purpose quite well for several decades. But over time, they've run into maintenance problems and leaking windows and crumbling aspects to the building. And this, of course, is just one small part of the larger problem of Milwaukee County having this huge backlog in deferred maintenance projects. We've just reported that Chris Abele and people in the business community and some of the state legislators from Milwaukee are now proposing a bill that would allow Milwaukee to increase its sales tax from 0.5% to 1.5% in order to help raise money for these types of projects. Because right now with the county has certain functions to deal with, including road maintenance, a lot of human services that are usually going to take priority over parks and cultural institutions. So places like the domes tend to be a lower priority, not because people don't like them, but because there are other spending needs that are considered to be higher for the county. And as has been amply documented by the Journal Sentinel and by other news media, Wisconsin's counties and Wisconsin's municipalities are under unusual levels of control as to what they can raise from the property tax base. That's because of a state law that was passed, I believe, in the early 90s. And Wisconsin, I don't know if it's unique among the 50 states, but it's unusual as to the extent that the state limits how much local governments can raise through the property taxes. What that means is we then get, at least in the case of Milwaukee County, these types of situations involving the domes.
And specifically, most states give allowances for their largest metropolitan areas.
Right.
So while Wisconsin isn't necessarily unique in that it puts limitations on these things, the fact that our largest municipality isn't given any kind of allowances, that is unique.
Yeah, yeah. So the domes faces this situation where you have some different choices. One choice could be make the repairs that need to be made. I think the tab on that was, if I remember correctly, was maybe roughly around $30 million.
What does that include? What repairs really need to be made here?
Well, I think a big part of it is the very nature of the domes itself. They're all glass, basically. And I think unfortunately, as striking as the appearance is, I think that does open up the possibility for more leaks than you would normally have, obviously, if you had a structure that was more conventional in its construction. So you've got a choice. You can spend $30 million to catch up on all the deferred maintenance and ensure that going forward for the next several years, the domes is in good shape. Or you could do what a task force to the county board recently recommended, which is raise $66 million and spend that money also to improve the domes, make some real big changes, some of which would be justified by the amount of revenue that spending would bring in. So, for example, you could take a portion of Mitchell Park, and I think this is the boathouse, if I remember correctly, could be converted into a venue for weddings. You could take a portion of that area and turn it into a restaurant, similar to what we have in Lake Park with Lake Park Bistro. The idea, again, creating a future revenue stream for the county to help it pay for that investment, but also pay for maintenance at the overall park going forward. That $66 million, while that's a very large amount of money, the task force figured that it could be broken down into different revenue streams. I think over half of that would come from what they hope would be private investments attracted because Mitchell Park is in what's called an opportunity zone. That's a new program that was created in the tax reform legislation that Congress and President Trump passed at the end of 2017. And opportunity zones are designated zones. They're supposed to be areas that are generally lower income areas, high unemployment areas, where in return for making investments there that create jobs, the investors get some very, very generous tax breaks from the federal government. So there's that possibility. There's also the possibility of getting historic preservation tax credits, money that the federal government and the state government, for that matter, provides if structures deemed historic are preserved according to their standards. That would provide the bulk of the money, over half. The rest of it, I think about $13.5 million would come from the county, and an equal amount would come through private fundraising.
If they did get that historic preservation tax break, mm-hmm. what kind of limitations would that put on how they're able to update the building?
Well, that's the give and take. You basically get, for lack of a better term, free money. You're getting tax credits, and they help defer a large portion of your expenses, but you have to follow the federal standards. So, for example, if you're going to replace windows, you got to replace them with windows that generally replicate what was there originally. I mean, if you like the domes, what the good news is you'll get the domes. You'll just get a much more efficient, updated version of the domes. But it should, according to the federal tax credits program, look very much the way it looks now.
Well, and that raises the question of this is a structure that we know has a lot of maintenance issues
right.
already, in part because, yes, there is so much glass. It's a building that is meant to bring in a lot of light, but of course also creates a lot of humidity on the inside, which mm-hmm. I'm sure
right.
is not
right.
helpful.
Right.
Are we looking at a situation where if we take that kind of money that we'll just be having this same conversation in another few decades?
Well, and that's what the people who argue against doing this would raise that point. And one other recommendation that's out there, and I don't know that it's gained much traction politically, was made by another task force earlier this year that recommended demolishing the domes and building a new complex for both the horticulture exhibits as well as the Milwaukee Public Museum, which is currently on the west side of downtown. That would cost an estimated $300 million. So honestly, I don't see that happening. And I've not heard of anyone really advocating that plan. But it was presented as an option. And of course, the Milwaukee Public Museum has its own sort of similar related maintenance, deferred maintenance issues that it's building. Prior to that task force recommendation coming out, there had been talk of replacing the Milwaukee Public Museum by going to another downtown location. We don't know where. They've talked about different places. I personally, I think probably down by the lakefront is where they'd like to be. But that had a tentative price tag of about $100 million. So none of these things are easy or inexpensive to accomplish.
You know, you've talked about a few of the options that have been laid out. What are the varying sides of this? I mean, I have heard people who've said, you know, this is a building or buildings that have had a lot of maintenance issues.
Right.
Maybe we should start from scratch. And then there are a lot of people who go, well, this is an iconic part of Milwaukee. We can't lose that.
Yeah, I think you've just framed it pretty neatly. And, you know, both sides present some pretty rational arguments. I guess one question I would have for the people who view it as iconic is, would you build it that way today? Let's imagine today we've decided we're going to do something like this that currently doesn't exist in Milwaukee. Would you do that type of design and that type of structure? I'm guessing probably not. And sometimes things that are viewed as iconic, not passing a value judgment here, let's just say buildings sometimes are of their time, and then they're not of their time as the decades go by. I'm not going to venture my own personal opinion as to whether the domes fit in that category, but one could make that case for the early 60s, that was a great idea. For the early part of the 21st century, maybe we should be looking at a different design that reflects how we currently do things.
Well, and that's a question I had. You know, looking at the domes, they are iconic in part because they're so unusual.
Right.
How do they compare to other more modern arboretums or nature conservatories of their kind?
Well, I think in general you don't do a dome-type shape anymore. I mean, I think you do a more conventional, for lack of a better term, boxy structure. You still have a lot of glass, obviously, but you wouldn't necessarily do it that way.
The domes, it seems like it comes with these kinds of maintenance issues built in, especially when you're talking about a structure that's meant to gather in light,
right,
and create, in many circumstances, in most of them, a more moist environment for the plants inside.
Yeah, or an arid environment for the desert dome, but yeah. And in fairness to the people I advocate preserving them, the maintenance issues are always going to be there. And I can't honestly say whether in the early 60s when this is getting built, whether the people who advocated that and approved it at the time thought that the maintenance costs would end up being quite as high as they ended up being. But I don't think those people ever envisioned a situation where Milwaukee County would have this much deferred maintenance, not just at the domes, but at all of its parks and cultural institutions. Go back and look at some of the news accounts at the time. These were things that people supported. There was community and political support for spending on these types of projects pretty much across the board. You didn't have a divisive sense of, well, this is too much money or we shouldn't do this. People wanted this because they felt it was a good way to spend the money. They felt it was an appropriate thing for a local government to do. They felt it was something that would enrich the community. And I don't think it was ever felt at the time that, gee, down the road, our children or our grandchildren will view this as a priority. And the fact that we're at that point today, I think that's more a reflection of what we talked about at the beginning of this discussion, about the limitations that are set on how local governments in particular, how Milwaukee's allowed to spend its money by the state legislature.
Well, and so we do have this task force that is asking really the state government to allow us this additional tax. Does that seem politically feasible?
No. I mean, I don't think so. And on one hand, probably some of your listeners right now are saying to them quite logically, well, what does the state legislature care? If Milwaukee County generally is a consensus, you have local leaders, the county executive, the mayor of Milwaukee, the business community saying, we want this permission to tax just ourselves in Milwaukee County. Why would that make one bit of difference to a state legislator from, say, rural Wisconsin or small town Wisconsin outside our county? And it's because I think you have a strong sense among the Republican Party that controls the Assembly and the Senate that, generally speaking, they're against tax increases, period. And that's been a cornerstone of their philosophy for some time now, and it doesn't seem to change even when it is applied just to a community that, in this case, wants to do it.
Yeah. If we can't increase taxes in that way, you know, we're looking at a very big price tag for this project. We're looking at a big price tag, though, for the parks in general and other cultural institutions, as you mentioned, in Milwaukee. What I mean, this is a big question, but what do we think the future holds if we can't raise that money?
Well, it's pretty grim. I mean, because in reality, if you can't raise that money, you're just going to continue to defer maintenance and things are going to keep falling apart. If you have a house and you need to replace the roof and you don't replace the roof, you know, things don't get better in your house. They get worse.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
You bet. And happy birthday to WWM.
Thank you.
Yeah, 55 years old. Don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't party too hard. You're getting up there.
Tom Dakin reports on commercial real estate for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. There will be a public hearing on the proposal to save the domes tomorrow evening at the Mitchell Park Domes Annex at 6 o'clock. There's more information at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break now and then speak with Madison author Dick Wagner about Wisconsin's early gay history. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. All places around the globe have a gay history, but it's still a largely untold one, particularly in Wisconsin. The national narrative of gay history often involves events that took place on the coasts, the most recognizable being Stonewall. But according to scholar and activist Dick Wagner, there was a pre-Stonewall liberation for gays and lesbians forming identities and support networks in Wisconsin. His new book, We've Been Here All Along, examines Wisconsin's early gay history from 1895 to 1969. From press coverage of Oscar Wilde's trial, anti-vice crusades, to post-war medical labeling of homosexuality as an illness, Wagner dives deep into history to find the legacy and resilience of early gay Wisconsinites and their influence on the evolution of the state. He joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski by phone from his home in Madison, ahead of an upcoming talk in Milwaukee. He begins by explaining why the early gay history of Wisconsin was worth his in-depth examination.
Dick Wagner, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk today.
Great. Delighted.
So your book, We've Been Here All Along, gets into Wisconsin's early gay history. And by default, all cities and places around the globe have a gay history. So what makes Wisconsin's early gay history noteworthy to you?
What's noteworthy to me is that before Stonewall, you had gays and lesbians in Wisconsin figuring out their identities. They were forming networks of support, which basically is the same liberation that starts to occur greatly after Stonewall. And so you have a pre-Stonewall liberation occurring that is hardly known by folks either in the state or even beyond the state's boundaries.
Right. People don't often think about gay history, especially in the Midwest, much less what occurred on the various coasts in the United States.
Right, right. So, you know, the title We've Been Here All Along is a little stab at, you know, like gay history began before Stonewall, and gay history was not all on the East Coast with Stonewall riots in New York, nor all on the West Coast with the early homophile organizations that were founded out there.
And how did Wisconsin's climate fare compared to other states across the U.S.? I mean, in general, places were very homophobic, especially in early history and especially post-World War II, but what was Wisconsin like?
Well, Wisconsin had the whole apparatus of homophobia. It had legal prohibitions, it had police enforcements, it had the courts opining about how horrible the crime of sodomy was. And then after World War II, it had the whole medical apparatus of sickness that was applied. So Wisconsin had the whole basis of homophobia, which makes the remarkable brave stories of men and women who sorted out their lives positively even more remarkable.
Right. And with researching this book extensively, to have great primary documents, photos, what challenges did you face when collecting your research? And what sources did you end up going to back and back again?
I came across surprising resources, and learning how to interpret them, knowing the general writing about gay and lesbian history nationwide, gave me sort of frameworks to go look. The book by Alan Burby about coming out under fire had just one footnote about a Truax study in it that was done by a professor at the University of Wisconsin Medical School. and a psychiatrist who was at the Truax Army Air Force Base. And so I actually dug out the study, and the study, while it was about endocrine theories of homosexuality, which was not proved by the study, nevertheless took some life histories of the gay men who were in the study. And one of the just sort of astounding things was that they all rejected the sickness description that had been applied for the medical screening of homosexuals out from World War II. And then there was this throwaway line that the researchers listed that four of them were members of a gay organization, and this was in 1945 here in Madison, Wisconsin. So that just sort of blew my mind that when you start tracking from sources that, you know, there's this sort of total resistance to the self-imposed homophobia that they're supposed to internalize.
And I imagine you needed to pay special attention to language, whether it was finding primary documents that were within gay groups in Madison and beyond. And the nature of your research with researching people during a period where evidence could be used against them. So finding those subtleties. So what did you find that were key instances or words to look out for, or what did you learn to like filter through in your mind?
Well, some of the visible folks were Bob Neal and Edgar Hellam in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. In the 1930s, the two of them bought these little Cornish cottages and started to fix them up and run an antique shop and then eventually sort of a Cornish meal operation out of these old homes. And there were lots of descriptions about them, and they talked about the partners. They didn't use a qualifier like business partners, but they also talked about artistic and about young men, even though they were middle-aged in terms of the lifespan of the period. So clearly these code words were being used to describe them. And you also get some other words that are less coded, like fairy or pixies or other things like that, that get applied to men in the pre-World War II period. So if you know what to look for, you can find the stuff.
With the structure of homophobia, the press certainly played a role in that. And I found it fascinating, you know, the power of language, whether that be in suppressing representation of people or recognition, even though most of the time it was negative, from where you start the book with Oscar Wilde's trial being covered in Wisconsin to beyond. With you as a researcher and a writer, how did you reflect upon use of language throughout all of the research you were doing?
I mean, it was interesting to see how people changed sort of positions. In the Vice study of the 1913-14 period, progressive sociologists roundly condemned permitting vice to be visible or seen in the communities. And then you had progressive sociologists in the 1930s beginning to talk about homosexuality not as a crime, but as a condition of people, and so they were exploring new theories, and the same with the studies right at the end of the war and following, is that, you know, they were showing that gay men and lesbians had actually served in the military services, even though the military had tried to screen them out. So the whole question about whether gay men and women could be patriotic or not, this whole part of that McCarthy period of the Lavender Scare. And in Wisconsin, there was resistance to that, as well as sort of admittedly hiding as well.
Right. And I did want to touch upon that with Senator Joe McCarthy being of one of Wisconsin's you know, big historical figures. You found he was prosecuting gays more than communists, yet that wasn't getting as much attention in the press. You know, we think of McCarthyism, we think of communism being rooted out by any means possible. Right. So what was this other side to it?
Well, McCarthy, in his own words, was quite against commies and queers. And one of the Republican bosses in the state urged the Republicans nationally to pick up the McCarthy charges because he was having an effect against homosexuals in government. So the whole apparatus, which was focused about trying to rid homosexuals out of government service, comes in with actually the Eisenhower administration. Previously, homosexuals might have been judged as a security risk on an individual basis, but with the McCarthy period and the Eisenhower executive order, it was a whole class of people just by their status that was considered a security risk. So, you know, Wisconsin went through that as well. There were folks at Truax who were sort of bopped out of the military services. But many more nevertheless served and resisted that.
Another thing to touch upon that I feel is important is also along Wisconsin institutions, UW-Wisconsin's treatment of gay students. You know, we here at Milwaukee's NPR, we're under UW-Milwaukee, which is, of course, part of the bigger UW system.
Right.
So could you touch upon how the gay students were treated at UW-Wisconsin-Madison in particular when it comes to regards of therapeutic discipline and the 1962 purge? I feel like when people think of our college institutions, this is not touched upon a whole lot.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
The Madison campus initiated a what they called, as you said, therapeutic discipline, where if someone was found out to be homosexual, and it was all men, that they were sent to psychiatrists because they were presumed to be sick and that maybe they could be adjusted or cured. Some of them played along with that because they wanted to get readmitted back into the university. Others simply said, no, I'm not sick. I don't want to go to the psychiatrist. So, but in those cases, they often lost financial support or were denied access to the School of Medicine or the College of Education because it wasn't thought those were appropriate roles for homosexuals to fill. There had been some earlier cases arising in Milwaukee at the extension operation, which caused a Regents investigation, which listed a 1,000-page report. And there were concerns then raised over counseling of a potential lesbian student in the Milwaukee system, as well as there was a controversy that arose with the firing of the dean of the extension system over in Milwaukee, who then charged that President Frank of the university and his backers in the Progressive Party were supporting immorality, including homosexual immorality, in that period. And the progressives and socialists in the state joined in the fight against that and beating back that attack.
Is that unique to Wisconsin history compared to other states who had similar things going on with Wisconsin's Progressive Party influence?
Right. This mini lavender scare in the 30s did not occur in many places. There was also, it was both a lavender and red scare in the 30s, and there were very few of those around the country. And to align the forces of the Progressive Party and the Socialist out of Milwaukee against that showed that they had moved from where they were in the pre-World War period, where they were all against suppressing vice. And in this case, they were sort of fighting against these sort of lavender scare charges that had been raised, in this case by conservative Democrats.
How did you find that people within the university were resilient in finding ways to fight back against what was happening?
Well, the remarkable thing is that you have the predominant narrative from homophobia that homosexuals are criminals or they're sick. And the way to counteract that was to try and get their own voices heard. It's similar to the post-Stonewall coming out experience of where telling your own stories is a way to contradict the assumptions, wrongheaded assumptions about gays and lesbians. And so by gay people participating in these studies by UW academics in the 30s and the 40s and into the 50s, they were trying to change the narrative by actually describing their own lives as not something quite so odd. And the other interesting thing was that in many of the comments, they would talk about not sex, but about love. And so that was also trying to change the definition, because the also other assumption and narrative was that, you know, homosexuals were all sex fiends, and of course heterosexuals were not sex fiends.
Right. I also want to bring attention to, you highlight a lot of people in your book. A couple on the front, Charlotte Partridge and Miriam Fink, have Milwaukee roots right here and founded Milwaukee's Layton School of the Arts. Could you describe to listeners a little bit of their story?
Sure. They met at Milwaukee Downer College, and female colleges were terrible breeding grounds for these sort of domestic friendships, which was the name for two women who would live together before lesbians became a popular name for that. And so they left their room at the college, which the college had provided them as part of their compensation, and moved off campus. And then they went on to found the Layton School for Arts in the basement of the Layton Galleries. They were very involved with the Work Progress Administration arts programs during the New Deal. And in fact, when Charlotte Partridge, who was more the artist of the group who had been running that, had to step down, her partner, Miriam Frink, stepped in for the while she was there. They were quite remarkable women. They were well known in Milwaukee's civic circles. They were on committees to honor Victor Berger's widow, Meta, who was very well known in the community as well. They built a house in suburban Thiensville and had a studio up on the north shore of Lake Michigan near Fox Point. And so here you had these two remarkable women leading their partnered lives together in the public sphere of Milwaukee. They also encouraged gay artists at the Layton School for the Arts. So they were a remarkable couple.
One thing I noticed going through the book is, of course, the different way that gay men were affected by the goings-ons of the time versus lesbians. What,
sure.
What are your observations on that? And well, is it the nature of history and the still yet limited roles women could play?
Yes, it was. Women's roles were circumscribed. And one of the conversations I had with one of the people who had reviewed the book was that women's sexuality was often discounted. And so, you know, men acting out sexually different was thought to be very dangerous, and women's sexuality was hardly noticed in so many ways back in those days. In fact, at one point, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that sort of the old statute against sodomy or crime against nature couldn't be applied to women because there was no male organ involved. Later, the legislature corrected that to change it to sexual perversion, which included both sexes. But again, that was just another example of how female sexuality was given a lesser prominence. One of the other things is that the Dean of Women on the Madison campus at the time of the gay purge in 1962 was a lesbian, and she wasn't interested in purging women students who might have been accused of lesbianism, and in fact, the student discipline files don't show any of those kinds of cases. There were some 50 women who were disciplined for heterosexual violations, and another 50 men who were disciplined for homosexual violations, but no lesbian violations.
What do you think is one of the most valuable lessons readers can take away from learning about Wisconsin's early gay history?
One of it is the agency of gays and lesbians themselves in establishing their lives and in establishing places where they could live and beginning to tell their stories. In other words, and this is the first volume of two volumes, and the second volume tells the remarkable story of how that early impulse for liberation in Wisconsin is fully realized when we become the first state to pass a gay rights law.
Well, Dick Wegner, thank you so much for your extensive work on this book. It certainly offers a lot of great insights. And thank you so much for the time you took to speak with me about it today.
Glad to do it, Audrey.
Dick Wegner is the author of We've Been Here All Along, Wisconsin's Early Gay History. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and he'll be in town tomorrow evening to give a presentation about his book at UW-Milwaukee. You can find out more information about it at WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, we learn why a certain Canadian Pacific Railroad bridge in Bayview is called the KK Can Opener. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. If you've driven into Bayview from Milwaukee on Kinnickinnick Avenue, you've passed underneath the KK Can Opener. But unless you were driving a vehicle taller than 12 feet 9 inches, you passed underneath the Canadian Pacific Railroad Bridge without incident. A lot of trucks aren't so lucky. They find themselves stuck, or worse, with their roofs ripped off. Writer Matt Rohde wondered why the bridge was so low, and he published his article Bayview Truck Eater in the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North it's a place where you see flashing lights on a regular basis.
There are other spots like this around the country, and Bayview is the locus for the state of Wisconsin, more or less, for having overpasses that are lower than you would expect or lower than truckers would expect. So they get stuck under there on a regular basis. And they could be delivery trucks. Sometimes delivery trucks are taller. You get a lot of those going through.
Do you find, when you were doing the research for this, are the standards just not connecting? Because trucks have a certain height, right?
They're supposed to be, if you're traveling on a state highway, you're supposed to be, and generally the rule in Wisconsin is you can't be higher than 13 feet, 6 inches. So the bridges are set to 13 feet, 9 inches to give a little bit of wiggle room in case you go over a bump or something. But not all the bridges really meet that standard, and they're often railroad bridges in Wisconsin and other places. And it's difficult to reorient them. I spoke to the railroad in this case, which is Canada Pacific, and they said, well, you know, the road clearance is really the responsibility of the road. So they were saying that the road should go lower, and the statewide highway department kind of danced around the issue and said, well, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do because we can't raise the railroad. That's private property. And so we're kind of in a difficult position.
They can't dig out lower.
Right, yeah. They can't somehow like...
excavate the...
like you would with a model train set.
Exactly.
So they put up a sign, and this is what states do, is they put up a sign that says, and sometimes they put flashing lights on it that says, the clearance is lower. And then people see these trucks going in, and it's like, well, what is wrong with them? But they're used to 99% of the clearances being... at least 13 feet, 9 inches. So when they hit one that's, in this case, it's a little bit more than what the sign says, and the sign says 12 feet, 9 inches. So when they hit one of these, they're not fully asleep at the wheel, but they're kind of lulled into a sense of confidence. And so they hit that, and then they, like a tin can, they get their top ripped off. And it turned out that there's 7 total crossings on state highways that are less than 13 feet, 9 inches. And 5 of them are in the Bayview area, including this one that's notorious. And another one is right after it. So
if you don't get your top ripped off on the first one, you'll get it on the second one.
Yeah. There was a beer truck this spring that I think it tends to be delivery trucks going into Bayview that hit it. And then it's not like a horrible, messy accident. It could be if a car was right behind them and slammed into the back of it. And it doesn't seem to have hurt the railroad.
That was my question. You know, with all of those trucks, you know, getting caught, is it affecting the structural integrity of the actual bridge?
The railroad, they had to rebuild it in 2010, and they didn't do anything to raise it then either. So that would suggest that it hasn't caused much of a problem. If it was a full-on collision of some kind, it might be a different story.
Usually trucks are going slowly enough that they're not going to like knock out pilings and things, you would hope.
Right, yeah.
You'd hope.
Yeah, so it's a difficult little spot. And it says in the story that Bayview is like a bear trap for trucks. And there are not a lot of good options to prevent this from happening.
I was going to say, they don't have a lot of other places to go.
Yeah, unless you get Tony Zelensky, the alderman, out there jumping up and down and waving his arms. There are laser systems, but as often as you see laser pointers nowadays, having a big laser system that would shoot through the rain to detect the height of a truck, I'm not even sure how that would work, would be really expensive.
And then what? It's going to flash at you saying, don't pass, yeah, don't pass.
Stop. Yeah, they could put more signage on the railroad itself overhanging, but you got to get pretty close to even see that. So maybe outreach to truck drivers but doing outreach to like any profession is a difficult thing because...
Well, there's so many, and there's so many, you know, individuals, people are doing independent businesses as well as delivery people for the bigger companies and that sort of thing. It just seems like this is not going to get fixed by sending out pamphlets or emails to people.
Right. Yeah. That usually doesn't work.
Yeah.
Anyone who works in an office knows, unless it was part of the drilled home when you got the special kinds of driver's licenses, that there are exactly 7 crossings where this doesn't work. And if you work in the Milwaukee area,
you need to know these. Yeah. Maybe that's part of your getting your license. I'm assuming most of the people who are driving that have some sort of commercial license. You know, and if you're going to be working in the area. Yeah, I'm trying to think out loud about ways to, you know, to prevent this from happening and having drivers caught. Because, of course, no company wants their truck ripped apart. You know, no driver wants to have that on his or her record. Nobody wants the traffic to stop because you have to peel metal off the road because, you know, they've hit the bridge, you know. And if, as you say, you know, Canadian Pacific is not particularly interested in raising the bridge, the city's not going to dig down lower to give more height. We're kind of in a position where it's like, what do we do?
Right.
You know, how do we prevent this? Except trying to put maybe more signage and say, you know, you have to be this short to go under this bridge or something, kind of like a ride at an amusement park.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a busy road too, which means whatever you implement, you wouldn't want it to slow down traffic too much. There's one, probably the worst example of this is in Ann Arbor, Michigan. There's a railroad overpass, and it crosses five different streets inside Ann Arbor, and it goes all the way down to 10.5 feet. So it's almost like a pinball game, and sometimes a truck will get stuck in one or the next one, and it's usually the two lowest ones that have the biggest issues. And yeah, they've not been able to figure out a situation. They looked at lowering the road, but there's a drain under the area, so that
they can't do that.
Yeah. And it would cost a huge amount of money to rebuild this big overpass bridge thing. So the railroad company has not been interested. So
we're kind of at an impasse, like we are here.
Yeah. I'm not aware of a case in Milwaukee where someone got seriously hurt. But yeah, it's not the safest situation because the trucks will get jammed in there. They'll kind of tilt to the side and people up the street at the bars, you see it happening. And
people pull out their camera phones and exactly. Just like, hey, yeah, no, it seems like it's one of those situations. I mean, it's both funny and not funny. It's a serious issue. Fortunately, it doesn't, as you said, nobody's been seriously hurt, but they could be.
There's a Facebook page that's from the voice of they call it the KK Can Cruncher, that will inform you if something happens or for some reason Bayview is very big on very specific Facebook groups that have a humorous edge, and that's one of them.
So this is the bridge itself reporting on what's happened?
Yeah. It's kind of, like an anthropomorphized voice of
the bridge.
I'm getting hungry.
Yeah, oh, it's time for a truck.
Yeah. They're often, I know at least the one this spring was a beer truck, but you got plenty of delivery trucks that are serving restaurants and bars and stuff in Bayview that are coming through. And they don't, it seems to be much less common that they get stuck coming out, because you could get stuck on the bridge just north, or even the southern overpass or the southern side of the northernmost overpass, you could get stuck, but that doesn't seem to happen as often.
It's usually going into Bayview.
Right.
So there's your lesson. Don't go into Bayview.
Yeah, right. Stay out.
Stay out.
Yeah. Stay in Walker's Point.
Well, Matt Rohde, this was a fun article. You'll have to report back and let us know if anything changes.
Yeah. Hopefully this stops everything and everything is fine.
Exactly. We can only hope. But it's great to see you, and thanks for coming in.
Okay. Thank you.
Matt Rohde wrote his article Bayview Truck Eater for the September issue of Milwaukee Magazine. You can find a link to the KK Can Opener's Facebook page at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then our Beats Me series answers a listener question about sanctuary cities. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Depending on where you are in the country, some cities, counties, and states have, in some way, designated themselves a sanctuary for immigrant families. But what does that really mean? And who has a say in the matter? In today's latest installment of our Beats Me series, WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell investigates.
There's been a lot of controversy over the last few years regarding jurisdictions becoming sanctuaries for undocumented immigrants. Some have created policies vowing they won't share information about a resident's immigration status with the Federal Office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. But for the common citizen who might not be sure of what it means when a city calls itself a sanctuary, I spoke with an associate professor at UW-Madison to get a clearer definition. Here's Sarah McKinnon.
A sanctuary city is not an official government term. It's really actually not a legal term at all. It has no legal meaning. But we use the term sanctuary city a lot to refer to local municipalities, counties, and states that don't cooperate fully with federal institutions in relation to immigration.
McKinnon adds that when a place designates itself a sanctuary, it's saying it will limit the extent to which it will volunteer local resources to do the work of federal immigration enforcement.
This might mean saying no to federal requests or detainers to conduct patrols. It might be refusing to jail an individual who's posted bond and the judge has said can be released. It also might mean refusing to gather more information that is needed to determine if an individual is eligible to receive services.
McKinnon says sanctuary cities don't violate federal law, so refusing to cooperate isn't breaking any rules. She also says the process of taking on the sanctuary title can be informal, and it can be anywhere from the mayor, a city council vote, or the governor who decides. One of our listeners submitted a question to Beats Me asking when and who determined Milwaukee was to be a sanctuary city. Well, Milwaukee is not a sanctuary city, and neither is Milwaukee County, according to the Center for Immigration Studies. But the Milwaukee Public School District passed a resolution designating itself a safe haven for immigrant families, following examples of safe haven school systems across the country. Here is MPS Board President Larry Miller.
Basically, what we mean by that is we will protect our children and their families from any intimidation by any source, so that if ICE ever approaches our students or our schools, we would have something in place to assist them, assist their families, and to protect them while they are in or around our schools.
Miller says the resolution received support from both immigrant and non-immigrant families. And Voces de la Frontera, a local immigrant rights group, advocated for that resolution, according to the organization's executive director, Christine Newman Ortiz.
Since the Trump election, our resistance to what we knew was coming down the pike was to really shore up protections and counter the hate mongering at the local and state level through what's known as sanctuary policies.
Newman Ortiz says the group also advocated in support of a resolution the Milwaukee County Board passed in early 2017 protecting immigrants who live here. Even still, sanctuaries have been challenged in Wisconsin. In 2016 and 2017, Republican lawmakers authored bills that would prohibit sanctuary cities for immigrants living in the country illegally and would withhold state funding from cities that didn't comply with federal immigration authorities. But neither of those measures were passed. As the conversation about adopting a sanctuary title continues to play out in cities and counties around Wisconsin, so has the conversation about law enforcement's role in working with immigration and customs enforcement. In 2017, former Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark applied to participate in the federal government's 287G partnership with ICE, which trains local law enforcement and then gives it authority to enforce immigration violations. The application was ultimately rejected. Under the new leadership of Sheriff Ernell Lucas, the department says it has no plans to participate in the program in the future. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
You can hear more of our Beats Me series at WUWM.com. We have time now for some music to end the show. Back in 2016, Canadian fiddler April Virch and North Carolina multi-instrumentalist and songwriter Joe Newberry stopped by the Lake Effect Studio. They played a few songs for us, including this original called I'm Going Home.
I've wandered far away from kin and everything I knew. I left my home, I left my friends. Sadder yet, I left you. I'm going home, I'm going home. I have been away too long. I'm going home, I'm going home. Did you miss me while I was gone? Did you miss me while I was gone? This hard old world, it beat me down till I was black and blue. The music gone, no more the sound, and nothing left I found true. I'm going home, I'm going home. I have been away too long. I'm going home, I'm going home. Did you miss me while I was gone? Did you miss me while I was gone? I lay down in some old barn. I dreamed a dream last night of you. You said you'd keep me from all harm.
April Virch and Joe Newberry playing their song I'm Going Home in the Lake Effect Studio back in 2016. You can find a link to their full conversation at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.